I came to New Mexico 5 years ago to spend a reunion weekend with my older brother, who lives here, and fell in love, and being somewhat impulsive, bought a house, and have been commuting between my my home in D.C. and New Mexico ever since, thinking primarily that I would bring to New Mexico a love of mountains and fly fishing. About, December of 2009, I was asked by Linda Roebuck Homer, who was CEO of the Behavioral Health Purchasing Collaborative, if I would be interested in working with the state to monitor the performance of Optum Behavioral Health, who at the time was having some difficulty paying providers timely and was under a corrective action plan with the state. So I came to do that in December of 2009 and ended that particular piece of work in July of this year. Okay. And along the way, met many wonderful people in state government and over time became interested in the larger question of the Medicaid program in New Mexico and ultimately was engaged through a competitive process to do the Medicaid modernization.
Okay. You know, I can't think of, there's so many people who've come here that way, that come to New Mexico because it's such a great place and then we take advantage of their expertise. So talk a little bit about the experience that you had in other states or with other projects like this.
Sure. I start by saying that I grew up in state government in the state of Florida in the late 70s and early 80s. And that was a time when Florida was making a concerted effort to pull all of its programs together and operate them in a very coordinated manner. An experiment that has not been repeated since, but one that was a very exciting time for somebody who's basically a policy nerd. Left the Florida and went to work for 9 years as the head of the policy and lobbying arm of the National Governors Association with a portfolio that included all of human services, particularly Medicaid, which is a big issue for all the states. And in 1993, I left that position and started my first consulting firm and then the consulting firm of which I'm currently the owner in July of 2000. We have specialized over the years in developing large-scale statewide Medicaid programs through the 1115 waiver process, which is a mechanism under federal law that enables states to be more creative and more flexible about the way they organize the delivery of services for Medicaid clients. And we've done everything from conceptualize them, write the waivers, negotiate them with the federal government, to procurements, large-scale procurements, evaluations, and full-scale implementation, which has run the gamut from literally living in states and running those programs, rolling up our sleeves and being side-by-side with state staff, to more sort of off-site consulting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you said the work in Florida was that you were involved in was not to be repeated, what did you mean?
Well, what Florida did in the early 70s, and it was basically a legislative initiative, they took all of the disparate human services program, mental health, what at the time was called AFDC, children, families, and families, developmental disabilities, voc rehab, all of it, elder affairs, and they put them together in one agency. And the agency was centrally run, and then operations were handled by districts. The state was divided into 12 districts. And at the headquarters level, the goal was to take all the disparate funding streams and state appropriations that tend to come in silos, but people don't, and put them together in a way that enabled us to try to wrap services and money around people rather than forcing people into particular boxes in order to get the money. And it was a very, I think, bold experiment, and I think it had lots of promise and in some cases worked brilliantly. Unfortunately, over the course of time, one agency after another sort of peeled off and became siloed again, and that's the way the state operates today.
Okay. One of the questions when the procurement process for this project was going on was, for the various people who were bidding on it, how much time were you going to spend in the state? And I don't think anyone ever made a contract about that, but it seems to me that you're spending a lot of time here.
I am essentially living here full-time. I go back to Washington about every 6 weeks, usually for 2 weeks. I have a staff there and a granddaughter, and it's important to me to stay in touch with both my business and my family in Washington. But I'm a full-time resident, in my own head at least, of the state of New Mexico, and I'm here significantly.
Okay. So you might say, since it sounds like you're planning to stay here also, that you have more of interest in whether this works or not.
That's absolutely true. I understand that in a state like New Mexico, you can't claim to be a New Mexican unless you and your family have been here for hundreds of years. But in my head, I'm a New Mexican, and I care very much about what happens to this program.
Okay. I'm talking to Alicia Smith, and we're talking in general, but we're also going to talk about Medicaid modernization is what they ended up calling it. Before we get to that, tell me, how much have you been involved in the implementation when you worked in other states, and how much do you expect to be involved here?
Again, it's varied from state to state. Three good examples. I was the consultant to the state of Georgia when it took its Medicaid program from fee-for-service to managed care, and that was a statewide implementation of managed care, which is a huge transition. And I literally had an apartment in Atlanta and was a part of the hiring of staff to run the program, the training, working hand on with the staff as we worked with the managed care plans through the implementation. Same experience in the state of Tennessee and the same experience in the state of Hawaii. So I love operations. I come from that kind of a background. And to me, the most beautiful concepts in the world don't mean much if they're not properly implemented. So I have a great interest in that. As to the question of how much I'll be involved here, I don't know the answer to that question. I hope I'll have the opportunity to be involved.
Okay. So the contract that you have, that you responded to and you were accepted or you were chosen for, just is up until the acceptance by the federal government of the waiver?
No, actually the contract that I have here takes us also through a procurement cycle, so that to the extent that the system looks different, and we expect that it will look different, I would be involved in the drafting of an RFP of proposals for whatever entities it is that we need to implement the program, and work with the state in the evaluation and at least evaluating the readiness of those plans to go live. So I'll be involved. The question of how much, how significantly is I think, somewhat open.
Okay. But if you draft the proposals, then you can't answer the proposals.
That's correct. But we'd be drafting proposals, for example, for managed care companies or for vendors, the kinds of things I don't do.
Okay. One of the things that people have been asking me or wondering about is the timeline for this project. So when do you think the waiver will be ready, and what's happening with that?
We're hoping to have the waiver itself ready to go to the federal government by the end of this calendar year. However, prior to that time, we will be making at least informal visits both to the CMS regional office and to central office to walk through our ideas and our concepts and try to iron out any substantial difficulties prior to the formal submission of a waiver.
Okay, so actually you'll pretty much know that they'll accept it when you actually put it in.
Well, it's always a bit of a danger to assume that CMS will accept it, but we certainly hope at least to identify where there might be points that we're going to have to fight over versus those that will be smooth sailing. Okay.
Both you and Secretary Squire have said that the state's Medicaid system is different from other states and that all Medicaid systems are different, but no one has actually said how. So I wondered if you could just say a few instances of how we're different from other states.
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that that's what I've heard the Secretary say. I think the point that she has made and that I would make as well is that Medicaid rules and regulations at the federal level tend to be stated in such a way as to create uniformity among and between Medicaid programs around the country. I think the point that the Secretary has made, and I, again, would concur, is that all states are different. And what works in one state may not work as well in another state. And perhaps an example of that would be that in some states, transportation is a benefit that is done through some sort of statewide vendor, relatively easily done because there are public transportation systems, there are good bus systems, it's easy to move people around. In New Mexico, state like New Mexico, as rural and a frontier as it is, it's going to be a much more challenging thing to figure out a way to make transportation work for people so that you don't have to get in a van at 7 o'clock in the morning to go to Albuquerque and not get home until 7 o'clock at night because you've had to wait for the five other people in the van to go through their appointments. So there are things that need to be tailored to fit the circumstances, geography being one of them, from one state to another.
Okay. One of the things that I always thought was different about New Mexico was that we have such a strong tradition of managed care, and I don't know whether that influences anything.
That's a very interesting question, and you're right. New Mexico has a strong tradition of managed care and has had managed care in place since, as I recall, about the mid-90s. That's not completely atypical. There were a number of states who made a move to managed care in the early 90s because it is considered a more cost-effective system. And so New Mexico is kind of in the forefront of states that made that service delivery change. There are other states that are either just now moving to managed care or are still operating in a fee-for-service environment. So New Mexico is, I would say, was a forward-thinking state in terms of its early-on move to managed care.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, actually, we had managed care with Loveless. Probably we were one of the first managed cares, and not for Medicaid population, but we have a tradition of other people being involved in managed care.
Oh, I see what you mean. So you're talking about managed care in the commercial sector as well. Yeah. Yes, I think that has certainly made it easier to use managed care as a service delivery system for the Medicaid population because it was already an accepted form of service delivery. And you know, folks kind of want to be in the service delivery system that their neighbors and colleagues are. So I think that made it a little easier.
Mm-hmm. After you have the points that you're thinking about and you start going to the feds to sort of try them out with them, or I'm sure you have a more formal, better term for that.
Sure.
Will there be a chance for people in New Mexico to look at them again, those who've come to the hearings and made comments?
I think in the end, the secretary and the governor's office will make a decision about how they want to unveil the final product, but we certainly are continuing to work closely with stakeholders. I'm going to start a series of meetings in the next 2 weeks to seek a wide variety of stakeholder input on a number of specific design issues. So I think this process is turning out to be much more iterative than people had first feared.
Okay. That assumption that was made, I think, because one of the principles was personal responsibility that people were supposed to address, and also they were talking about carrots and sticks. And so people just made an assumption that you were going to institute premium sharing and co-pays and all sorts of things like that without just because those words evoked that. So do you want to say what is being actually looked at?
Sure. You're absolutely right. The term personal responsibility has evoked a lot of fear and many people who believe that that's code for charging people money to access health care. The way we've used personal responsibility is to think about the various ways to align the system so that there is more accountability and more incentive for people to take an active role in their own wellness and in their own health. So we think of personal responsibility in two aspects. We are looking at the potential to implement some sort of sliding co-payments on services where it appears, after we look at the statistics and the data, that we might be able to drive people towards more efficient and effective care settings. For example, if we can come up with a way to help discourage people from going to the emergency rooms when it's not an emergency, we can both save money in the system and, we think, achieve a better outcome for folks. That alignment of that kind of desire or goal requires not just asking individuals to be responsible, but we're also going to be working with the managed care plans to discourage the use of hospital emergency rooms by incentivizing their providers to keep non-traditional hours, to work with hospitals, to do a better triage, to do a better warm handoff of people to either a clinic or a primary care physician. And we're seeing some results from those kinds of strategies. So the idea is to try to align the system so that everybody's got a part in making care decisions and in making the system work more efficiently. On the other side of personal responsibility, we're looking at developing, and we want to start small, but some sort of a pilot to help folks, to reward folks for engaging in healthy behaviors. So, for example, if mom takes her baby to all of the wellness checkups recommended by the American Academy of Pediatrics. She makes the appointment, she takes the baby, she does the follow-up. There's a certain credit or dollar amount that is deposited into an account for her, and then she can access that and use it for things that Medicaid doesn't buy, over-the-counter drugs or Pampers or potentially education or a gym membership. I mean, we haven't arrived at a design for that feature here in New Mexico, but that's the kind of thing that we mean when we talk about carrots.
Okay. I think one of the thoughts has been that with Medicaid, we're dealing with poor people, and they don't have the same resources that everyone else has. So they can't just say, okay, my kids are getting involved in drugs, I'll send them off to a special program that'll take care of that, or I'm going to go to the gym because losing weight is a good idea. So how do you deal with the limited resources that they're dealing with?
Well, financial responsibility side, you're absolutely right. We're talking, particularly since New Mexico has not expanded coverage under Medicaid except through the SCI program to a higher income population. We're talking about a basically low income group of people. And I think the Secretary has been very clear that when we look at the potential for co-payments, we're looking at them on a sliding fee scale with sensitivity to what people could realistically afford to pay. On the incentive side, part of the idea behind the incentive side is to give people the wherewithal to go to the gym or to, I don't know, there's some states that have experimented with giving folks the opportunity to use the credits at a farmer's market so that it makes it easier for people without income, with low incomes, to eat healthier. So there's a variety of ways to look at this, and one of my work groups that will be meeting next week, which will include advocates and HMOs and doctors and community outreach people, is to kind of look at what would be a good pilot design to start with in New Mexico.
Okay. I'm speaking to Alicia Smith, and we're talking about Medicaid modernization in New Mexico. It occurs to me now that our listeners may be having ideas in reaction to what you're saying, and so if they want to send in some emails or suggestions, what is the I know there's a mechanism set up for that.
I mean, I don't know the website off the top of my head, but there is the opportunity, and in fact, I received from someone in my team yesterday a compilation of all of the comments and ideas that have been submitted to date via the website or snail mail or telephone. There's a telephone line set up as well. And we're developing a checklist so that folks will be able at the end of the process to see how we dealt with their comments. So people will know that we took them into account. We may not implement all of them, but if we don't, there will be a reason for that.
Okay. That was going to be my next question, because I know after several of the hearings you've said that you were really interested in what people had to say. And there was some criticism of the secretary for not listening to people because she was out doing a press thing or something like that. And so I wondered how the actual process would happen of listening to them.
Well, again, in addition to the minutes, notes that were recorded live in most of the meetings, I believe not in Albuquerque or Santa Fe, but in the earlier public stakeholder meetings, all of those comments were recorded and were posted back on the website and have now been captured by my team, as well as comments that people have emailed in or sent in by mail. So we do have a master checklist of all of the ideas and comments that people have shared with us. And again, we'll be reflecting at the end of the process, or as we go through the process, how we are dealing with those comments. And we've gotten some terrific comments. Mm-hmm. People have been very generous with their time and with their ideas.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, actually, doing the waiver, which is really quite technical, I think, and just involves like writing a really big term paper, and then negotiating it, and then thinking about how it can be implemented, is a lot of work to get done within that time period. And in fact, it seems to me like it's really too much work. So why are we doing this at this point when our whole system is going to change in 2014?
That's a very good question. It is a tremendous amount of work, and we're going to do everything within our power to stick with our timeline. And the reason for that is that if we are successful, or when we are successful, we will be implementing a system that we believe is more efficient and more streamlined and more consistent with the goals of buying outcomes and buying better health for people, knowing that not everybody's going to be perfectly healthy, but everybody can be as healthy as we can possibly make the system work for them. And we want to do that prior to 2014 so that when there is an influx of new people into the Medicaid program, we've got a more efficient, streamlined system for them to come into.
Okay. Is there any work being done on getting more providers and getting access to providers? Because that's really the, not just doctors, but all the providers up and down the list, that's really the barrier, I think.
Well, it certainly is a huge barrier. And at every meeting, stakeholder meeting, private meetings that I've had, the issue of access has come up. The issue of workforce development and of the recruitment and retention, not just of doctors, but of all kinds of healthcare professionals into the state of New Mexico. That's not a problem Medicaid alone can solve, Our hope is that we can make better use of technology. I think we can expand access in some ways by use of technology. We've got a pretty good telemedicine program in the state of New Mexico. We hope to build on that. The ability of people who are living in rural communities potentially to Skype, to have contact with their healthcare providers. We want to increase the use of the promotoras, and those are the kinds of ways in which we hope to capitalize on the things that are already happening here and to deal with the fact that we do have an access problem. Mexico's not alone in having an access problem, but it certainly has a significant one, and I wish I could promise you that a Medicaid waiver would cure that problem. We're going to do the best we can to deal with it.
Talk about how Medicaid works now and is going to work after these changes with the rest of the health system. There are some areas where Medicaid really drives the system, and there's more urban areas where it doesn't. And how is it all going to be seamless?
Oh, now if I had the answer to that, I could retire. You know, how it will be seamless is a tough question to answer, and you're quite right. I mean, Medicaid is by a significant margin, the largest purchaser of health care, at least in the state of New Mexico, and the second largest purchaser of health care after Medicare in the country. And therefore, a lot of what goes on in Medicaid has the power to drive the system. How it will work seamlessly, I wish I had an answer to that question, but I think our goal here is to do a better job of making Medicaid a more modern healthcare system so that it's more reflective of some of the positive trends that are going on in the commercial market.
The administration has talked, when they've brought forth this idea, they talked about as a way of saving money. They talked about needing to make changes because Medicaid was getting too expensive and was projected to do so in the future. The kind of things that you're talking about are making things more efficient and more effective, and you don't really talk about saving money. Is there a break here, or is it just a different a way of looking at things?
I think when I talk about creating an efficient and effective healthcare system, I'm talking about saving money. But let me say a word about saving money, and Secretary Squire has been quite clear about this. What we're talking about trying to do is bend a cost curve. And that's different from saving money in this respect. When I think about saving money, or if a family thinks about saving money, I think I spent $100 this year on my cable bill, and next year I'm going to reduce the number of channels I get, and I'm going to cut my cable bill, and I'm going to save $25. We're not talking about that kind of saving. What we're talking about is, if left unattended, Medicaid, which now consumes 16% of the state budget, will continue to grow at a trend which is alarmingly high. And the goal here is to bend that curve so that the steepness, that's probably not a word, of the rate of increase comes down. And that you see a more gradual incline or some sort of flattening of the enormous growth in costs that we have seen over the last 5-6 years. Now, part of that is driven by the cost of healthcare, and that's brings me back, and I think brings the secretary back to the concept of modernization and creating efficiencies in the system that will make it more cost conscious.
Okay. Could you talk a little bit about your idea or your philosophy around social engineering? Because that's another thing that has come up. You know, it's another way of looking at the carrot and incentive idea.
Social engineering. I understand, of course, the concept. You know, when I think about social engineering, I think about the question of whether government or the private sector, for that matter, have the power to change human behavior. And I don't know the answer to that question. I think we've got some evidence that on the short, over the short term, you can change human behavior. Whether that's an enduring change, whether that's an appropriate role for government or for the private sector is a much more difficult question for me to answer, and not one I've spent a lot of time, frankly, thinking about.
A former HSD secretary, Pam Hyde, came here because she was doing a study of the system, and then she ended up staying here for a number of years and becoming involved in the system herself before she went on into Washington. How do you see your role? Is the medical part what you're interested in, or would you be interested sometime in doing another experiment the way Florida did of putting everything, all the HSD things together? What do you see happening with you?
I see retirement, Susan. I believe, past the stage in my life and in my career when I've got another massive social engineering project inside of me. I hope to become a wise elder over the next 5 or so years and to spend more time up in the Pecos fly fishing. I will always be enamored of public policy and always be devoutly committed to doing what I can to make a contribution. But I don't see myself becoming a Pam Hyde and running an agency in the state of New Mexico or anywhere else.
That was going to be my next question, was about fly fishing. Talk to me about that.
Fly fishing is the ultimate relaxation to me, and something I fell in love with right after I fell in love with New Mexico. I'm not particularly good at it, but there's little beside my grandchildren that gives me as much pleasure as standing in the middle of a fly stream, watching the birds soar overhead and the incredible blue skies of New Mexico. And I am committed to getting better at it, and that's one of my retirement goals.
I think that one of the other words that was scary to people and that people reacted against was the idea of wanting more flexibility. That's how this project, the Medicaid modernization, was proposed in the beginning. And people kept worrying about flexibility for what? And we've talked about that today, but do you want to add anything more about why we need to be flexible and maybe allay some fears about flexibility for what?
Well, you're absolutely right. That has been a term that's raised a number of concerns. There are, again, a limited number of things that the secretary actually has the authority to waive under current federal law. But we are looking at the waiver as a vehicle to enable us to take all of the Medicaid program, or as much of the Medicaid program as ultimately we decide is appropriate, and to create a single comprehensive service delivery system. And surprisingly enough, you would think, gee, why does that require a waiver? And the answer is that the federal law, the federal Medicaid law, which was created in 1965 and frankly has not been looked at in any kind of comprehensive way to make it more modern, still has enough boxes and check marks and regulations such that in order for a state even to do what New Mexico is doing now requires a waiver of certain federal rules and requirements. Mm-hmm. So we're just looking to take the flexibility that is afforded, that things that the secretary can waive, and put them together in a comprehensive delivery system, service delivery system that works for the state of New Mexico.
Have you had a chance to talk to the governor about the ideas and about the progress?
I have not had the pleasure of meeting the governor and have not spoken with her.
Well, thank you. Thanks for spending the time.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.